Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network, and today's episode focuses on literature studies. My name is Yakir Englider, your host, and today we will speak on the book The Bear, published in 2020. As human beings, we are a part of nature. However, we have a complex relationship with it. As many of you, I dedicate myself to learn how to be nature. But too many times I wonder, what are the ways to be there, as it is, without to romanticize it, but to learn from it. I wonder about the language of nature, my role as a human being, how to learn its language. When I hear people say, look how peacefully nature is, I'm thinking about the fact that nature includes death and life together, that everything is steady, but also changing constantly, that fallen trees become a ground for a new life to appear. I also wonder about the memory of nature. Can nature carry our memories, our touch, and being when we are gone? The bear brings us back to Genesis, but on the opposite direction. A father and his daughter are the last two humans in the world. How they will lead their lives. What kind of relationship they will have between themselves with nature. And what a father should teach his child before he leaves her to be the last human being. What they should do with their time. The bear raises spiritual and theological questions and touches them in a whole new way. Andrew Krivak is a National Book Award finalist and winner of many other prizes. He lives with his wife and three children in the shadow of Mount Monadnock, which inspired much of the landscape in The Bear. As we will learn in the interview, his personal life includes deep connection to nature, to spirituality, and to life.
Andrew, welcome. Can you please share with us a little bit about your spiritual or religious background?
Sure. So I grew up in a small town called Dallas, Pennsylvania. It was west of Wilkes-Barre in a place they call the Back Mountain. My mother was, her parents came from Eastern Europe from what is now Slovakia, and what was then the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And my grandfather actually fought for the Austro-Hungarians in the First World War. And my father was, he was one of five children, and his father died in the coal mines when my father was three. And his sister was, my grandmother was 5 months pregnant with his youngest sister. So this widow struggled a great deal, and they left they were raised what's now called Byzantine Catholic, so Eastern Catholics outside of Orthodox, outside of Orthodoxy. And so when my grandfather died, my grandmother took them all and moved to Wilkes-Barre where she could get some work. And so it was the Irish Monsignor at Sacred Heart Church who said, let's, you know, I'm taking care of this family. And so my grandmother cleaned schools, and all the kids went to Sacred Heart Church. And she was the sort of rock of faith for them. And my mother as well, you know, her parents were Catholics from the old country. So I was raised in this Eastern European Catholicism. And I say that because it was the church was really a happy place for me. It was all about ritual and all about the times of ordinary time, which I realize now isn't mundane. It's the counting down, the ordinal, right? And the times of feasts and the times of penance as well. It was all, you know, the liturgical cycle was so much a part of my growing up. And then also too, my parents are both have advanced degrees and they read a lot and they were both college educated, of course. And so my mother was always throwing books at me, you know, read this, read that. My older brother was throwing science fiction at me and my sister was throwing J.D. Salinger at me. So I had to duck for all the books, but the ones I picked up, they all seem to have a religious edge to them in some ways. And I think, long story bearable, when you grow up in that kind of environment for a Catholic boy in the 70s, and Catholicism is a good experience for you, a kind of literary experience, if you will, an intellectual journey. You got to wonder about, you know, what this religious life thing is. You know, is it right for me? So I went to St. John's College, Annapolis, to study the great books and read philosophy and Greek. And I mean, St. John's College is a religious experience in and of itself. but then afterwards, you know, I worked in a boatyard for a couple of years on the Cape, and I went to the writing program at Columbia to write poetry. And in New York City, I had gotten in touch with some Jesuits with the New York province. And they, you know, I had, when I was working on the Cape, I'd gone to Spencer Mass to visit the Trappists at Spencer to see if maybe I would want to be a monk, because of course my mother had me read Thomas Merton, Seven Story Mountain, along with St. Augustine's Confessions when I was in high school.
But when you go to do this journey, how old are you?
St. John's. So, right. So let's start in college. Junior year of college, I go up to the Benedictines in Abiquiu for the sunrise service and think, wow, this is what a life, you know? So junior year of college, then I'm 22, 23 when I visit the Trappist at Spencer and I'm on my way to Columbia and they say, look, if you want to be a writer, you should be a writer. Otherwise, you're not going to want to be a monk. So I moved to New York City. And I do have a cousin, my father's brother's son, who is a diocesan priest in Allentown, Pennsylvania, not close to where you are now, who's been a priest for a long time. And he and I met up at a wedding and we were talking about this. So I had just graduated from college. And he said, well, you know, when you get to New York, you should look up the Jesuits and they understand spiritual direction. So I did. I literally called up the novice master. I'm sorry, the vocation director on the phone in New York City, and he put me in touch with a priest at Fordham who was teaching theology but also did spiritual direction. And so one summer, I worked with some youth at risk in the Bronx, in the South Bronx. It was sort of a Fordham University Big Brother program, and I kept doing that throughout the year. And I worked in what's called a higher achievement program in the South Bronx for kids who the Jesuits in the community can recognize have the capacity to do well, but they're not getting a good shot at it. They do a sort of summer prep course of math, science, reading, so that they can examine Bronx science in schools like that. And you know, a fair amount get in, or they, at least this was 1988. That was, you know, a while back. So I came back my second semester, my second year at Columbia, and I was just thinking, you know, this is the Jesuits are really the ones who do it the way I, who lived it the way I thought it ought to be lived. You're still out in the world, but you're, this is, you know, you're all in. And so I applied and I got accepted. And after I did my MFA at Columbia in poetry, I went up to Syracuse, New York, and I was a Jesuit scholastic. I took vows in 1992 and was a Jesuit scholastic until 98. So 8 years. In the Jesuits. I entered in 90, I took vows in 92, and I left in 98 in theology, my theology studies after 2 years as a novice, during which you do the spiritual exercises, 3 years studying philosophy, 2 years teaching philosophy at Le Moyne College, and then my first year of theology studies. And I'll say this, I left because I no longer found the kind of excitement and creativity that I entered with. And I do see it as an arc as we start to talk about the story, but I always think of storytelling in the way that I understand it from my days reading Aristotle, is there is a beginning, a middle, and an end. And in the middle of that, you're driven by the struggle. And I see my time as a Jesuit as a narrative arc that I had to enter, move through, and move out of. And there's not a moment I regret. And I also, one of my greatest fears when I was about to leave the Jesuits was, would I regret this? But I just kept at the discernment process, kept at the prayer. And where did my heart lead me? Where was my desire? And since having left in 1998, July 98, I've not for a moment regretted that grace. It was a grace-filled moment to enter the order, enter religious life. And it's been a grace-filled moments ever since having left. So I carried something with that. And I do, I see it as religious, living a religious life, small r, small l, right?
I love it. So
in a nutshell, that's it.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, we're in a podcast for the world, but on July 1998, it's exactly the month when I left my ultra-Orthodox upbringing in the yeshiva, and I was joined the Israeli society and to the military. So it's fascinating that the same month, two people in different places are doing changes. And now we talk. Andrew, I think when I'm thinking about the image, like the image that you build in the Burr, and we will come soon to that of the girl, because in most of the book, she is a girl, a young teenager. It's fascinating because in so many ways, when I was reading your book, and this is one of the things that make me to fall in love with the book, is that I was thinking about her as a monk. I choose a monk and not a nun because this was my feeling. And I was thinking about her father, which is in Hebrew, Abba, which is also one of the names, you know, of the fathers and mothers of the desert and of, like, almost as a student, like in so many elements, she's a student and he's a teacher. And at some point, something changed, you know. But maybe before all of that, what have made you to write this book?
Wow. Well, what you just spoke about, I think is really brings a lot of stuff that was probably bubbling beneath my religious imagination right to the top. But let me start with the origins of the book. I do want to talk about the girl as
we will.
As monk.
We will.
Yeah. Good. So we're recording this. I'm in Jaffrey, New Hampshire on Thorndike Pond, where we've had a house for about 6 years or so. And I think it goes back to that time. We bought this place in 2014, and I was finishing up my second novel, The Signal Flame, which was about this town, this fictional town of Darden, Pennsylvania. Very similar, of course, to the Pennsylvania I just told you about in the beginning. And it disappeared like all other works of literary fiction do sometimes. It's just what you have to accept. But so we came up here a lot, and I was really thinking about what did I want to do next. I had in mind a three-book series about the family that I was writing about in Darden. But I was also just enjoying being with my kids there at a time when they're enjoying what's around us here in nature in this place. And it also took me back to Pennsylvania, growing up in a very rural spot. So you see the circle starting to tie in. When my kids were really little, I used to tell my boys about a story about my father and me looking for our lost dog, Troy, in the woods. And it was a talking bear around Christmas who gave us the gift of finding him. And they just loved the idea of this talking bear. Even when they knew animals didn't speak, they're just like, can you tell us the story about the bear? And for me, I had to get them to go to bed because I wake up early to write. And if they didn't sleep, I didn't sleep. And if I didn't sleep, I don't write. End of story. So they liked this. And I started thinking about, should I sit down and write a children's story for them? And in the meantime, they just kept growing. And I was thinking more and more about literary fiction. And my editor from The Sojourn, my first novel, Erica Goldman at Bellevue, she had sent my kids a copy of Randall Jarrell's The Animal Family, which is about a hunter and a mermaid who raise a family of animals, one of which is a bear. And I was just fascinated by this genre where Jarrell, one of my favorite poets from grad school, is writing this book about two children in a prose that's just so efficient and simple, and it's it lifts all those expectations and veils you have about the animal kingdom and nature and the animal lives. So I wondered about that for the bear. And as I was writing, it wasn't working out for me as a young person's book. And I just kept thinking more and more about this idea in literary fiction of the coming of age and the quest, not so much the quest narrative, I think that's been used a lot, but the idea of how journey shapes us. Cannot not go on a journey without being different ontologically at the end than we are at the beginning. And so I really pushed that book into a place where I wanted to think about, was there a way in which without it being a YA novel or something allegorical like C.S. Lewis, The Wine, The Witch, and the Wardrobe, where the animal kingdom or nature and humans could somehow get past that veil between them. And I was out, I knew that the girl and the man, that was already a very spare in nature relationship. I increasingly became really fascinated by this idea of nature as protagonist.
The bear. And it has an epigraph from Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay on nature from his second series. We did not guess its essence until after a long time. The last two were a girl and her father who lived along the old eastern range on the side of a mountain they called the Mountain That Stands Alone. The man had come there with a woman when they were young and built a house out of timber, stones pulled from the ground and mortar they made with a mix of mud and sand. It was set halfway up the mountain slope and looked out onto a lake ringed with birch trees and blueberry bushes that ripened in summer, with great bunches of fruit the girl and her father would pick as the two floated along the shore in a canoe. From a small window in front of the house, the glass, a gift the woman's parents had given to her after having received it themselves from the generation before, so precious a thing had it become as the skill for making it was lost and forgotten. The girl could see eagles catching fish in the shallows of an island that rose from the middle of the lake and hear the cries of loons in the morning while her breakfast cooked over a hearth fire. In winter, the snows began not long after the autumn equinox and still visited the mountain months after the spring. Storms lasted for days and weeks at a time, drifts climbing up against the house and burying paths as deep as some trees grew high. Often the man had to wait for firewood or charge out to his tool shed at the edge of the forest with a rope tied around his waist. But when the wind settled, the skies cleared, and the low sun shone again, the man would wrap the young girl warm and tight in a pack, walk out into the stillness of winter and float on snowshoes made of ash limbs and rawhide down to the frozen lake, where the two would spend the day fishing for trout and perch to the ice. Snow covered so much of the girl's world from mountaintop to lake that for almost half the year, all she could see when she looked out that window was a landscape at rest beneath a blanket of white. And yet, no matter how long winter lasted, spring followed, its arrival soft and somehow surprising, like the notes of birdsong upon waking or the tap of water slipping in a droplet from a branch to the ground. As the snow melted, black rocks, gray lichen, and brown leaf cover emerged from the once uniform palette of the forest floor, and the thin silvery outlines of trees began to brighten with leaves of green against the groupings of hemlock and pine. Those were the days when the girl left the house in the morning with her father and studied a new world that pushed up from the dirt of the forest and emerged from the water at the edge of the lake. Days in which she lay on the ground beneath the warm sun and wondered if world and time itself were like the hawk and eagle soaring above her in long arcs, she knew, were only part of their flight, for they must have begun and returned to someplace as of yet unseen by her, someplace as of yet unknown. So that's the setting of the novel. And I wanted to capture that very much that northeastern mountains landscape and what's the word? Just get an image of the man and the girl alone, but living day to day, season by season, year after year, because that's all that's left for them.
Which is fascinating, because when we think about the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden, we think about Adam and Eve are there alone in a very peaceful, in an interesting relationship, very healthy relationship with nature.
Right.
And the last two humans are, in a way, living there. But also, it's not that everything is giving to them, but they need to be part of nature and working and in order to find the food, in order to deal with the weather. Do you see, what are the images that come to you, Andrew, when you think about this image of the Garden of Eden and what you try to describe us in the book?
I had Genesis in mind pretty much the whole way through, I have to say. One of the questions people ask is, why didn't you give them names? And I did not give them names because Adam and Eve give all the things names. That's their job, to give them names. Right. And so I imagine for the last two wouldn't need names, and they would sort of not so much pull them back or take them away, but just let that need to name disappear. I even wrote a section where the bear asked her what her father called her. And I imagine a dialogue, where she said, what do you mean called me? I was always by his side. He never called me. He said, well, I mean, if he needed you to turn to him, what would he say? And she said, I would turn to him no matter what he would say. And the bear's trying to get him to say, what's your name? And she's like, I don't have a name. But I realized that would have been over, it would have overdone it a bit.
But it's fascinating, Andrew, right? Because, I mean, in the Jewish tradition, the idea that Adam and Eve, they are giving names is in order to categorize things.
Yes.
Right? This is why they give names. And also Adam is giving the name to Eve because it's like, because she's coming from him, in all the story in Genesis. But here, and then the scene is deeply connected to shame. And my feeling, and this is one of the gifts of this book, of the many gifts, is that you give us in a way how to take off our clothes, how to take off the things that we need because we feel ashamed of being humans. Mm. And they come back, in my feeling, to be part of nature.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this idea of shamelessness. And I would say that one of the things I was trying to get at with respect to nature was I do believe that there's a certain hubris among humans that we are at the sort of apex of where we find ourselves, and that the things we take because we deserve them. And not everyone thinks that, but certainly that's the way we're going. And what I wanted to do was to suggest that even storytelling itself has a hubris to it, and that what if the animals, and this idea of the talking bear, I thought more of, perhaps there's a veil between us and the natural world, and if that veil were to lift, all things would communicate, or I should say, we would find, the girl finds, she's the last, the veil lifts for her, she finds that communication and care and hope, even on these journeys, is something that every living thing shares. And so where did I wanted to go with this? So the idea that an animal would talk, it's more than an idea, an idea that the animal would communicate with her, that she would be open to the channels that nature presents, and that the trees are the historians of the forest, and that perhaps what I hope to strive as a hopeful note at the end of the novel was that the history of humanity would never be lost in our story, because nature itself, we are a part of nature itself, so much a part of nature itself, that nature itself will always remember that story and will never let it die.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So it's nature in a way witness us, and in a way it's echo of who we are, right? I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
And we need to start in a way to be open to listen in different way, like to create a new language in a different way.
Right, right. Nature's witness. I love that, Yakir. It's such a powerful turn again to think about nature as protagonist.
Yes, you know, there is a beautiful Jewish text from the Talmud, which is, you know, it's around something at the beginning of the first century, the second century, that says that the reason why Adam and Eve were born on the sixth day is God tell them, if you know how to behave with nature, so then your role is to ruling nature in a healthy way. Sure. You are like, I prepared everything for you. However, if you do not know how to deal with nature, so everything in the world was there before you and they will be after you.
After you, yeah.
And right?
And
in a way, your book really gave me the idea of, you know, what does it mean to seriously be part of nature in the meaning that we are one of many things, but also we are part of something which is bigger than us. It's like we are not at the center. Mm-hmm. For the first time, I really felt how we can be not less human when we are part of something bigger than us.
That's exactly what I was aiming for. Yes, yes, thank you. One thing I wanted to say too is, as a novelist that I found doing in this book, and I really hope to do more of, I don't see it much. I found myself making my characters look out. So it's not that I'm against interiority, but I was struggling to reread Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment at one point a couple of years ago, and I was getting so deeply claustrophobic inside of Raskolnikov. And I thought this interiority is literally driving me crazy. I'm sure Dostoevsky had that in mind, but I think that a lot of times, and I've noticed it too in other fiction writers, a lot of times there's a way in which the interiority of a character's thoughts is where the development happens. And I was thinking, what if the development happens while the character is entirely seeing the world? It's not that I'm against interiority. It's just that I want to turn it out. And so I think if one is going to write about nature, or at least the beginning of anything that seats itself in nature, has to have that turnout. You know, no more rhetorical questions of the mind, no more what will happen here inside the mind. Just look out. And the passage where the man and the girl are in the foundation, the place of the foundation walls, and he finds the piece of mirror. And he says, your mother had one like this. And she looks in the mirror and it's similar to, you know, it's a better image than it would be from how she sees herself in the lake. And it's a perfect spot for her to think about her mother. What would this woman have been like? How is she like her? And she sticks it in her pack and says, I'll make arrowheads with this. They have to so much live in the now, right in the now, that there's no, it's not that there's no time for interiority, because there's plenty of time. The man certainly has it as he's moving towards his death. And I would hope that a reader sees that as the young woman becomes the old woman. Imagine the kind of interiority, as you say, this monkish old woman must have had living as the last one on earth. So that's to be accepted, but day to day, in that ordinary life, it's all about looking out and seeing what's in front of you, living right now.
It's so incredible. I must tell you, you know, it's today it's the Jewish beginning of the year, the Rosh Hashanah, and so I was thinking that your book is my favorite fiction that I read in the last year, and it's such a gift. And Andrew, so let's try to go even deeper than that.
Okay.
So I want to go back to the relationship with the father and also with the mother. So they don't have names, but in a way they are living in as a father and a child, but also as an Abba, as a father in the meaning of a teacher and a student. But then we have also the big teacher, which in a way is a memory that the mother represents.
Yeah.
And the mother who is not there, but we have everything of the mother by the Abba, by the father. And they go each year to a pilgrim, right? To a pilgrim journey to the grave of the mother.
Right.
And I'm thinking, can you share with us I had a feeling that you have something at a religious, almost religious teaching there. It's like the relationship, I will say it even more in maybe in a clearer way. In Western society, I feel many times that we lost the relationship that can happen between a teacher and a student.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Professor at university is not a spiritual, in a way, teacher, is not like a religious teaching. And I understand why, because many times the relationship are unhealthy and a lot of, you know,
right.
there are prices for that. Yeah. However, we lost something and your book bring it back. So how do you look on the relationship between the three of them?
This is a great question. I think that when I knew that these two would be the last two, and I knew I knew first that the mother's story had to be right up front, and had to have in it everything that the girl become woman later would also mirror at the end of the story, but also that there was that the father would be responsible for leaving his daughter alone in the world as the last. So this consciousness is there and pressing quite heavily. What would I do as a parent? I thought about that a lot, and it may be an interesting way in which this book never was a young adult novel. It really had to be literary fiction precisely because of the weight on the man, thinking about his child and how he would prepare her. In some ways, he can't ever prepare her. She's going to find things that he couldn't even imagine. And who knows after he goes, how long she'll last. But for me, I was one of seven, and my father was a great man. I have to say he never put an obstacle in my way. We didn't have the same temperament. I was closer, I think, to my mother, sort of philosophical temperament, but my father was really the outgoing one. The one who would hunt. He taught me how to fish. And he was a city kid raised, you know, in the coal mines, but at the World War II, he was a infantryman in World War II. And so that's, I think, where he really came to have his respect for those things of the outside world that would, you know, make him be self-sufficient. So he hunted and fished, but he also was a great reader too. And, for some reason, he was the one who said to me, "Why don't you just go study philosophy?" You know, he and my mother were the ones who told me to go to St. John's College. They didn't tell me; they suggested, and I thought, "Wow, what a great thing!" At a time when parents were saying, "You know, study accounting because you'll get a job." But also the other thing I realized with my father was that he let other men be mentors. For me and for his sons as well. And there's, you know, I think that comes right out of the Odyssey. Mentes has to tell Telemachus where his father is because his father's not there, and that notion of the mentor. So I know a guy named Tom Kravitz, whose daughter and I were great friends in high school, pretty much through all of school. I worked for him as a gardener, and he was the guy who taught me so much about plants
what you could eat, what you couldn't eat, what, you know, how to make teas, pine needle tea, strawberry leaf tea in the spring through the snow for vitamin C. A great man up the street from us, Harvey Odell, was a fantastic sailor. And we were about 5 miles from Harvey's Lake, which was a big natural lake in Pennsylvania. And he came down one Saturday when my dad was, and I were working in the garden. We're just pulling weeds in my dad's garden. And he said, "Hey, I'd like to take Andrew sailing tomorrow. My daughter used to crew for me and she's gone off to college." And I thought, you know, maybe he'd be a good crew on this Mob Jack series. And so I think my dad was a little bit like, that's a little too, you know, yacht. It was the Harvey's Lake Yacht Club. But he asked me if I wanted to do it. And I said, absolutely. Boats. Wow. And I did. And what that experience with Mr. Odell helped me to do was to think about the practical things, how to fix stuff. You know, in sailing, you're always thinking about the next thing to fix, the next thing to tweak. And you've got to, so hands and head are constantly working together. That was, you know, all that stuff too is in the bear, of course. So a long answer to your question, to think about the ways in which I was very conscious of the man's both practical need to prepare the girl, his daughter, but also I think too, Yakir, I'm glad you asked this because I do. I was aware too of the spiritual need as well, and you know,
yes,
this is there's only one moment where the man who knows he's just gotten bit, has the onset of tetanus. And he wakes up in the morning and he looks out at the sky, the horizon and the ocean, and he says, "Please not yet. She's not ready." He knows he'll have to die, but he's worried about his daughter. She's not ready yet. But, you know, who is ready? When will she be ready? He has to play out his own narrative arc. And so too will she. So I don't know if that entirely answers your question, but I is to say that these what we might have called in religious life sort of formational times, you know, you know, 8 years in the Jesuits, and I certainly had my share of spiritual directors, all men who would say, "Look, my job is not to get in the way of that relationship between you and God." And so I think the man and the girl, you know, there is some other. I try to animate nature in such a way that it's not so much an animus swirling around, but that they know they're alone and yet not alone because they live so close to the land that they must know this.
Yes, yes. And then also after the death of the father, the bear became and also some other, like other animals became part of the teachers of the girl.
Yeah, teachers. I mean, the bear is, I really thought of the bear as, you know, mentor, capital M, you know.
So, yes. Yeah. Yes. Andrew, I want to ask a question. I have a theological question, and you know, these are the moments where I hope my English is not going to fail me because it's not my first language. God is not appearing in the book. Mm-hmm. However, God is all over, or God as I wish God would be, is all over. And, you know, your book reminds me, there is one book in the Bible that God is not appearing. There is no mentioning of the book of the name of God, which is the book of Esther.
Right.
And God is not there. And the rabbis in the beginning of Judaism, they say that the name Esther is actually come from the verse Aster, Aster Panai Mikem, which means I'm going to hide my face from you because you need to learn to see me as I am, and not as what you wish me to be.
Yeah.
And in a way, God is everywhere. And I wonder, since you dedicated so many years to monastic teachings and learning, and to more mystical one, I wonder how it come into the process of writing the book.
I think that I was so aware, obviously, of the fact that my Catholicism is front and center, and I've written a memoir about my time as a Jesuit. Again, I that would have been to me an interior life of the author, which I was careful of trying not to let sneak into the bear in an obvious way. The same way that I want the characters in the bear to be looking out at nature. I thought, okay, this is my time to look out at the ways in which the last two would understand that wonder, the wonder of what is greater than they are in the world. And I'll tell you, I don't want to ruin this for people who will read it, but I suppose by the end of it, when I had thought of it, there was no way to not so much hide or cover, but I just let it be. And the one I've already mentioned was where the man speaks to the horizon and says, she's not ready, not yet. Who's he speaking to and why? Why does he look out for that? And the other one is to this character of Thorn, which actually comes right here from this lake that I live on. It was a story that was told to me by a hunter about a Native Americans centuries ago when the first colonists came. He wasn't sure if they were French or English. The story, though, lives on of this small tribe of probably Lenape, and they were this one hunter. I forget his name, Samji maybe. He was out hunting, and the colonists massacred the group that he came back to find just smoking weetus and dead dead tribespeople. And he, in a rage of revenge, he went out to this island and massacred all their Europeans, he referred to them, who had killed his people. And he did so by changing into like a mountain lion, animals that were known predators and hunters. And in this way, killed in the guise of these of three predatory animals, killed all the colonists who wouldn't have understood how powerful nature was. Especially as a force of revenge. I wanted to sort of change that. And so the character of Thorn becomes, in the story that the father tells, it becomes both a story that's passed down about what is passed down, but also about the spiritual life of the place, that there is something that will not die. And he understands it as this character of Thorn who rescued his people from the devastation of nature, from the forest fires. And so I think that these are ways that I tried to animate the sense of wonder. One thing, I was reading this a couple weeks ago on an event, and for the first time I read the section where the girl says to the bear, how is it you can understand me? And the bear says, really the question is, how is it that we've always been able to understand other animals in the forest and things like that? It's just that you others, you humans have lost the ability over the years because you just didn't want to have it. And as he tells her about the way in which the natural world communicates, there was a line that I just could not write. And her wonder, her doubt turns to wonder. And she starts to listen to the way in which the bear tells her the trees are historians and lawgivers, and they listen to everything and have long memories. And all animals communicate in some way, because that's how the connection lives.
I love it. I love it. I wonder, I'm thinking how we can gain it back. You know, it's like, what needs to happen to us? And what are the ways to gain back this ability to communicate with nature? But I also wonder, because the girl and the animals, after the death of the father, they also eat animals.
Yes.
Right? So it's like I was thinking, okay, from the moment that she's communicating with nature in a way, she's going probably not to eat any more animals. However, the animals that she's eating, or that the bear that he brings her, right, they are not animals that she's communicate with.
Right. But except though, this is a tricky thing, Yakir, too, that I really struggled with, was yes, she has to eat. And it's through communication. It's through that moment in the woods where she's at the, just before the grove, where she understands that, in fact, at a deeper level, not wondering about this myself, at a deeper level, it's need, it's sacrifice that the animals are willing to sacrifice for those who are playing their parts. It's the part of the animal, yes, part of the stag who comes to her in the forest to, you know, he's been given that role, is to be her food. You know, I there was a book called The Secret Life of Trees maybe several years ago. Fascinating book that I'm certain everybody has read. Like I'm sure Richard Powers has read this, who wrote The Overstory. The trees take care of themselves. There are certain trees that are less susceptible to drought, that will live longer in drought, and trees that know the drought will kill them. And those trees will die earlier in order to give the moisture in the ground to the trees that will survive. It's just a fascinating notion of community. And I think sacrifice is always part of who we are and what we do. In fact, I think we've lost a sense of that these days. It's all about, you know, what's in it for me? What can I get for myself? There's no sense of sacrificing what might be comfortable to us for the sake of someone else who might really be suffering.
Thank you.
Just as a tag on to that, at the end though, the girl become woman. I do hope readers, now we've given all the secrets away too to this book too, haven't we?
You know what I love about the book? It's one of these books that even if you know everything, you need to experience. It's like art. We're talking about, but you need to experience.
Thank you so much. But she's, you know, by the end, she's eating, she's a vegetarian for all intents and purposes. You know, she's not eating any more animals. She doesn't need, she's existing on the plants, you know, fish, she'll catch some fish in the winter, but she's got enough plant protein in the summer that she can live, and she doesn't need much. So I hope that comes through as well. She's played her part so well that those animals that sacrificed themselves to her, she did precisely the job that God asked Adam and Eve to do on that sixth day, right? You know, play your part. Don't mess it up, right?
Yes. So. Yes, 100%. 100%. Andrew, I was wondering, because we are jumping from being a girl to become the old woman at the end. And I was upset on you that you didn't tell me what she did all her life.
Yes.
Because I was learning so much about relationship with nature just by seeing her as a girl. And I said to myself, wow, just this knowledge I can dedicate the rest of my life to learn. But then, and then she is an older woman, and I'm wondering what she has learned all of these years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think it's a mysterious. I think it's there. It's like, this is my role. It's like, in a way, you said you are telling me, this is me as a reader, I give you some tools, now go and find yourself there in nature. And be her in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, as a novelist, I'll just speak practically for a second. Pace. I think about pace more than anything. Pace of the story, of the arc, how will it work out? And I knew I was working with a short novel, a novella length, and there was a way in which I realized that she had learned so much up to that point that the only next possible step would be to have her be old, because she's just lived every single day since the moment she comes back and buries her father next to her mother. She's lived every day in the same way that you see her live the last, her own last day, where she lays down and she breathes her last breath, and she lays in the dirt until the snows come and the snows melt and the samara seeds from the maples are sprouting up and pushing through her leathery skin and her bones. Because that's exactly who she is. She's of the earth.
Yes. And since you speak about this moment, Andrew, let's speak a little bit about death. Death is happening there. And one of the things that I took from the book is that you can be deeply sad, the sadness of the death of the Chi experience that probably the father, when he described, you know, how when his wife died, there is a place of pain and grieving, but there is no anger. There is no anger there.
Yeah. I remember when my father passed away, it was my first real experience of the emptiness of the stop time, you know. And I describe it as a cliff, a sort of vertiginous cliff where you're running and you're running and you're running, and then you just realize you have to stop yourself, like, and you're almost dangling over the edge of it, and you have this vertigo. And you could fall. You're, in a sense, you're emotionally falling, but you're not. And so I've tried to carry that with me. It's not an anger. I was never felt an anger about it. I just felt a kind of a deep sadness move to wonder. And I think what I wondered the most about was this whole notion of what's next, of resurrection on the Catholic side of things, on a memory. In many ways, what lives on? I haven't come to the answer to that question, but I think in some ways the bear was my attempt to answer it as best I could. There's no anger because if one has lived with if one has lived as best one can, living in the now and struggling with what is right in front of oneself, and can honestly say that they have that struggle is authentic and unique and personal, then I think that when I see a person like that die, I don't feel anger. I feel a great sadness because I miss them a great deal. But I also feel a sort of peace at knowing that that was a story well written. It was a life well lived. And I think no matter what happens in the end, nobody knows really. That's a cliche, of course. But what I really am curious about, and what I really think is the closest thing to certain I can come to, is that in the natural world, not just of this earth, but if you start to go out like concentric circles of ripples in the universe, it's not an elimination of matter, of material. And there's even in the animating force, is it in Hebrew nefesh? Is that?
Yes, nefesh. Yes. Nefesh,
yeah. That sense of dynamism, you know, where does that go? That breath, even if it goes off into the air, it goes off into space. If I think about this entire, universe of all lives, I think it is really just a change from one material state to another. And most fascinating to me will be what persists after that. Like, I don't see any anger in that. So I'm actually, this notion of, and it's not a sort of pantheism or just a get down into the dirt, but I do imagine a kind of, I'm looking out at Mount Monadnock right now as I say this. I imagine a sort of post-death happiness of finally seeing a much larger vision and experiencing and being part of nefesh, soul, yes, life, in a way that we could never be as humans and that we lived our entire lives towards. And so now it's like an aha. And skin and bones doesn't say that. Right, skin and bones just gets down into the dirt, and trees grow from it. But something—it's that thing that will say, "Ah, yes, now I'm getting a little closer to what it all is." That's what I envision. Mm-hmm. So
fascinating. I think that one of the things that came to my mind when as reading your book is that there is a circle there, like, because when the trees, you know, falling down, new life is coming in the forest. So when the animals are dying, like, she's using part of them, you know, she's using part of the flesh to eat, but she's giving the back, like the rest of the animal is going back and becoming part of trees. And in a way, there is a curiosity, right? It's like, I'm dying, but what is going to happen with me now? I'm going to become now part of something larger. However, the choice of your book, in my point of view, is you challenge the fact that God created human beings in God's image, because in a way, I think that the fact that, or at least, you know, the Jewish Christian theology, right, the fact that we were created by the image of God, according to the Bible, made us to be different than the other parts of nature. We think that we have the reason, we control nature, etc., etc. And your book bringing us to the other direction. It's like how we can become more part of nature, even that we are humans and these are trees and animals.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. I guess I hadn't realized I was doing that.
Your book brings a lot of theological questions, which are fascinating.
Yeah.
But I want to take that maybe to another perspective that I would love. Sure. She chooses when she comes back, Andrew. Mm-hmm. She chooses not to read books anymore.
Yes. Yeah.
And in a way, she's saying goodbye. And it's the same thing. Like in a way, she's saying goodbye to something very strong about us as humans.
Yeah.
And maybe this is the image, what we think that we are different than animals, right? She's saying, I don't need the books anymore because I have a different journey to do or a bigger journey to do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel like I'm, well, how should I say this? I don't want to be seen as sort of knocking down the Judeo Christian creation story. I mean, in many ways, I just read that over and over again so deeply. But I do feel like there's a way in which there are elements of the story that perhaps those of us who have lived through time and in the wake of that creation story have not misread it so much as haven't gotten as deeply into understanding it as we really can yet. And I think that I was trying to, in that way in which the girl becomes the old woman in the mountain and so much of that hierarchy is eliminated. And yes, I that section where the books just become, you know, mouse food and then dust, I want that precisely to mirror the earlier part where the man teaches her to read and to write. And all she really wants to do is listen to him read to her. She just likes the sound of his voice. And so, you know, isn't that really ultimately what the stories, what all these books should become is voice. So, and once she has that in nature herself, she doesn't really need the books, doesn't need the house. I just wanted to force that. I shouldn't say force, but I wanted to follow that path as far into what would she do with respect to the path that she is on. And it wasn't like I wasn't in control of the narrative, but I was really sort of seeing where that would take me as it took the girl. And I couldn't extract myself from that notion of, no, she's this path wherein she's becoming lesser. She's diminishing while nature is increasing. It just became what I felt like the novel wanted to say and had to say at the end there, especially. I was very conscious too at the end. I mentioned dominion in the last couple pages. I was really kind of conscious of going back to Genesis. I think in an earlier conversation, you and I had been talking about Robert Alter. I was really moved by his translation of Hebrew scripture and the way in which he understands the fact of repetition, the paratactic structure of Hebrew, the ways in which these stories emerged as great narratives, independent of you know, Christian tradition or Greek tradition. And I think I just
that final section where she diminishes was my own kind of bow to Professor Alter and to Gloria in Hebrew scripture, where I just wanted to bring it close to it in my own way and have her, have the dome of the heavens is that under which she must rightly pass away, and in which she is so completely exposed and when yet one was the only thing I tried to get.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that you left me at the end of the book is, now that there is not any more humanity in the world, in nature, what is the loss that nature happened to nature? Mm. What's it like? Is nature is going to keep telling the stories? Or stories are connected to us in some ways?
Yes. And this, I think this goes back to the my comment before about nature itself. Like we cannot not be forgotten as humans when it's over, because nature is so encompassing that it will tell our stories too. And it leads to a question that's arisen a couple times, and I thought about in the writing of it too, is if this woman is last, and we're talking about storytelling here, who tells the story of the bear?
Hmm.
Who is the narrator?
It is fascinating. Yes. And also the bear, like the young bear who come to take her body, he knows he also got a story, right?
Yeah.
And maybe in some ways, as you said, the world is carry, like nature carried our stories.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming to the New Books Network and for writing The Bear. It was really a pleasure to have you here, Andrew.
Well, thank you, Yakir. I mean, I can't imagine a better day on which to have this conversation with you. So thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.